I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When you make the choice to have children, there are a million factors, both internal and external, that go into your decision. And although it's a highly personal choice when it comes to if, when, and how many children you're going to have, there are a ton of external factors that serve to push you in one direction or another, from financial pressures to government incentives to cultural norms to hopes and fears for the future. You may not be thinking about how governments and nonprofits and big think tanks are trying to influence your decisions, but you can't deny that the world around you has an impact. So when we think about climate change and human activity, and studies like the recent UN report warning that a million non-human species are threatened with extinction, or the report a few months ago highlighting a much shorter time frame for when we could see some of the worst impacts of a global temperature rise, it gives us pause and a little bit of space to think about a question others have been raising for some time now: how to control a global population that continues to rise exponentially. Is curbing population growth key to a sustainable future? How do we do that without limiting people's personal choice and free will? What would it even look like? And what is the conversation happening in Vermont around those ideas? We're going to swirl around in that conversation today, and I'm joined by two people who have thought a lot about it already. William Ryerson is president of the South Burlington-based Population Media Center, which uses storytelling on TV and video especially to address big challenges and issues like climate change, population growth, and the rights of women. Bill Ryerson, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
And John Erickson is a professor of sustainability science and policy at UVM's Rubenstein School of Environmental and Natural Resources. Professor Erickson, nice to talk with you again, too.
Thank you.
So, can we talk about first the scope of the problem when it comes to human population? Because it's hard to talk about solutions and change and what we want to do if we don't have a good sense of what, why this is a problem and what the problem is. Bill, do you want to start us off?
Sure. There are a couple of ways of looking at it. One is, since 1970, the population of the planet has doubled. Another way of looking at it, a little more relatable, is every day at the dinner table, there are about 225,000 additional people pulling up to the dinner table hoping to have food than there were the day before. That's net growth per day. So every 3 days, a new Vermont.
And you're not talking about, you know, replacement here, people dying and other people being born. You're talking about
growth. That's net growth, births minus deaths.
So what? Good thing. We need growth. We got a big planet.
Great, according to some economists who have never studied ecology. Clearly, the planet has limits, and one can argue what those limits are. And those limits change with changing technology. But it's very clear, just in the example of climate change, that we're not living sustainably. If we were living sustainably, future prospects would not be changing. But climate change and the today's topic, loss of biodiversity, are clear indicators that we're not living sustainably.
How do you think about it?
Well, thankfully, I'm an economist that has studied ecology.
So you two can sit next to each other comfortably.
Absolutely. I mean, I was reflecting on this morning. I turned 50 this year. So in my lifetime, population has doubled. The economy, the world economy, has quadrupled, and world trade has grown by more than 10 times. We see the effects of this all around us. We see the effects on the climate. We see the effects on biodiversity loss. And we're hearing about the effects from this latest assessment from the UN, which was a 3-year project, 15,000 reference materials, over 1,800-page report. The summary of that report, which was just released a couple of weeks ago, that is signaling that upwards of a million species, 1 in 8 species in the world, is endangered.
Cindy says, I've been baffled by the lack of serious mainstream discussion over the past decades about the effect of population growth on the environment. It's not only time to talk about it, it's way past time. I fear, though, that the non-science-based power plays, which are rampant in our current culture, are going to make this near impossible. I personally have given up any hope that we can turn this ship around. You know, Professor Erickson, when we talk about this growth, and you mentioned these statistics, they're not necessarily bad. Why do you believe it's bad?
Well, along with population growth comes growth in consumption. we're seeing a world that is filling up with our presence, and it's not leaving enough space for the rest of life. You know, the story that's coming out of the United Nations of this tremendous biodiversity crisis, extinction crisis that we're in the middle of, is, you know, questioning the very sense of what is the good life, right? Is the good life that, you know, we take domination over the entire planet for ourselves? Is the good life something that is a narrative more about balance? Should we be thinking just about the values of nature to us, or should we really be starting to question the nature of value itself? So I think, you know, this is a very, very ripe conversation for us to be having, especially in the global north, because so much of what we're doing to the planet is driven by our consumption. And the population of the world is the consequence.
So, Bill Ryerson, when we think about biological imperatives, you know, I know this isn't true for all species, but for many species, you know, there is an insatiable goal to reproduce and to take over as much as you can. Again, not all species have this as their growth model or their model for sustainability. But, you know, you do look through the animal kingdom and it's like you're gonna keep going until you reach carrying capacity or until something else stops you from continuing your population growth, which usually is a negative impact on the landscape such that you can't continue that growth anymore. So do you believe humans, through our big brains, have the ability to stop what would seem to be perhaps just our biological imperative?
Clearly we do. And if you stop and think about it, if you had visited the planet 3 billion years ago, you would not have survived more than a minute. You couldn't breathe the air. There was no drinkable water. It was filled with toxins. There was no food. So basically, you would be finding something that was somewhat like what Matt Damon found on Mars. And 3 billion years of evolution of the web of life is what makes the planet habitable. And we are systematically untangling that web of life. But we've also seen great success stories, and most of these have been based on human rights approaches, such as elevation of the status of women and girls' education. Look at Europe. Much of Europe now is below replacement-level fertility. True also of Japan. True also of middle-income countries like Thailand. So it is indeed possible for humans to move in a human rights context towards replacement and below replacement level fertility. And ultimately, because we are now threatening our own existence, let alone the rights of other species to exist, we need to move towards negative growth as rapidly as possible in a human rights context.
When we look, though, at a country like Japan, at least in the past, it's been seen as a crisis, not as a good thing necessarily, that it was below replacement rate.
Again, an economic model that doesn't understand ecological limits. So we need to look at places like Japan and New Zealand as the models for the future, not rapid economic growth countries, because we can't sustain endless economic growth. It's the economic activity of humans that threaten the environment. And so we need to move towards a sustainable economy that doesn't imply endless increases in consumption of resources.
So, Professor Erickson, how do we do that?
Well, I just spent a week in New York City with a group of PhD students from the University of Vermont and McGill University, talking to groups around population and environment, talking to the Population Council, the United Nations, International Federation of Planned Parenthood. And it's no secret that we've brought down fertility rates through family planning. It's no secret that there's a huge unmet demand for, again, from a human rights perspective, a demand for family planning. It's no secret, as Bill mentioned, that when we elevate the status of women, family sizes go down. So this is actually, population growth is slowing as a globe. There are still some tremendous challenges in places like sub-Saharan Africa where population growth is continuing unchecked. But this narrative of this is bad for the economy is starting to creep up. I just read an opinion article of California. California's fertility rate is such that its population growth is slowing. And the opinion article was making the case that California will have less political power in the future if it has a smaller population. There was just a piece done about how China's population could be peaking much sooner than thought. And again, the context of the article was that's going to destroy the economic growth model that depends on a growing Chinese population. So it's just mind-boggling that we've finally gotten to the point where we're seeing the slowing of population growth, and the narrative of this is going to destroy our economy has crept in.
Well, so Dave wrote in to say the problem is that when birth rates fall, it causes an aging in the average population. That in turn causes a host of other problems, including increases in healthcare costs and lower economic growth. There will also be a severe lack of caregivers for the aging population when birth rates decrease. So how would you address that?
So this is a challenge. We see that when fertility rates fall and human life expectancy continues to increase, we get a decrease in population growth, even perhaps a stabilization. The first good sign of that is we get what's called an economic dividend. We bring more people into working age categories. They're creating more income, increasing livelihoods within that country. We also get a second economic dividend with an aging population because savings convert to investment, convert to greater stability for the economic system. The big question is there a third stage of this? Is there a third dividend that doesn't have to be environmentally destructive? Can we support what's happening in Japan, support what's happening in Italy, support what's happening in the United States? Minus migration, the United States is also slowing down its natural population growth. So this is the time where we have to think, can we thread the needle? Can we stabilize population and at the same time dramatically reduce consumption?
But what do you do about the at least short-term problems that Dave was mentioning, like more people who are in the older categories and fewer people who are in the working categories? I mean, we certainly talk about it even with things like Social Security and keeping Social Security and other programs like that funded for people who are now in their 30s and 40s. So, you know, in the short term, there's going to have to be some pain, right?
Well, this report, which was fascinating to me, a UN-level report talking about economic transformation. We have to think about transforming the economy. We have to think fundamentally about the labor-leisure-work-life balance. We have to think about how a longer week and two jobs or three jobs a piece maybe is not a sustainable way for thinking about adjusting to this new reality of a declining growth trend in population. To transform the economy means transforming the way we eat, the way we drive, the way we do energy, the way we live, work, and play. And it means taking seriously this economic structural problem that has historically been tied to population.
What do you think, Bill?
Certainly, when you look around the world, there are countries that are so concerned about slowing growth that they're paying people to have babies. This is true with the baby bonus in Australia. Germany is paying $16,000 per German baby born. Now, when you stop and think about it, some German couples are going to have babies anyway. But if they're only going to do it to get the $16,000, they are the worst motivated parents.
Does anybody really do that, though?
There are some.
Child is going to cost you a heck of a lot more than $16,000. And, you know, people who are planning to have children, you know, are probably thinking about that. I mean, the question is, not everybody's planning to have children, and, you know, children happen sometimes. But, you know, are people really saying, I'm going to get a $16,000 bonus, and they think that they're going to net positive on that?
Those that have turned their children into orphanages after they have adopted them or after they have been born are a few examples of the worst motivated parents. But my point isn't that it's a major issue in terms of the money, because you're right, raising a child just through high school is going to cost several hundred thousand dollars in a context like Germany. But the issue is, as John was just pointing out, we have countries that are fighting the idea that we have to eventually reach a stable population. And we can't continue to grow the population. And paying people to have babies does lead to all kinds of problems because, indeed, we are postponing having to come to terms with the very issues you raised about aging. One of the things that Germany could do very simply is change the retirement age. by a couple of years. That would solve their problem in terms of retirement allowances. But instead, they're paying people to have babies. It's just not thought through as to what can we sustain over a long period of time.
Through policies like the child tax credit in the United States, are we essentially paying people to have babies, do you believe?
In a way, yes. Again, it's minor, but it is in a way something that's encouraging people to have children. And, of course, anybody reading newspapers are seeing articles and op-eds from economists saying, oh, my goodness, we're too slow in our population growth. We need to have more consumers in order to expand the economy. Just imagine if Vermont were at 1 billion people and economists were saying, well, we need more people in order to keep the economy going. Clearly, people are not living in Vermont because they want a place with 1 billion people. But the ultimate consequence of endless growth is we'll get there or we'll run out of oxygen and resources before we do.
Other thoughts coming in from people. Katie writes, access to family planning for all women worldwide would make a huge difference. Fran says, I'm very concerned about the rate of population growth in regards to the climate crisis. If I were of childbearing age, I would not be having children. We're talking about this question of whether and how population growth should be addressed globally, federally, and maybe even statewide. I mean, it's certainly something we talk about a lot in Vermont when we talk about a need for more people, a need to attract young families. What exactly are we thinking and how might we address climate change through questions about population growth? We're talking with Bill Ryerson, president of the South Burlington-based Population Media Center, and John Erickson, professor of sustainability science and policy at UVM's Rubenstein School of Environmental and Natural Resources. Let's go to Samuel, who's calling in from Worcester. Hi, Samuel. Go right ahead.
Hi. There's something I've been saying a lot lately, and you know, there's obviously a lot of incremental solutions other than banning births, but what I've been saying, you know, it's a real difficult issue for people. But what I've been saying is, how long would it take? I've been telling them, how long would it take for the world population to go to zero if no one had any babies? You know, it's like 100 years or something. So if you obviously scale that back to 1, 2, 3 babies, or you know, 1 or 2 babies, it's longer. But it's a temporary issue, and that's the point I'm making. It's not like it wouldn't take that long. You know, China did it. That's what I want to say. Thank you.
Yeah, Samuel, thanks for the call. So Samuel's saying it wouldn't actually take that much time to have a significant reduction in growth or even to go to sort of a negative birth rate around the world. Sid is on the line with us in Montpelier. Hi, Sid. What are you thinking about?
Well, first of all, it's refreshing to hear economists talking about the fallaciousness of boundless growth. And it's something that in the few economics classes I did take at UVM, you know, there's a range where some are still teaching that there is that infinite growth is possible, and then some are teaching that it isn't. And one of my the things I think about and I'm wondering is that I find it very likely that in my lifetime there will be a pretty catastrophic reduction in population due to climate change and other factors, and I'm wondering what modeling is being done or what that future might look like as, you know, whether it happens or not. I think there will be substantial die-off potentially in a lot of the parts of the world, low-lying coastal areas, parts of the world that have desertification growing, various things like that. And
yeah, Sid, let me put that to John Erickson because it's such an interesting question. I mean, we were talking earlier, I brought up this idea of, you know, are we just sort of going to go headlong into the future until something stops us and then population growth is curbed because the world is not a sustainable place for humans to live? And I think it sounds like the idea here is, could we do this in a way that is less damaging to people, less damaging to the world, but also, you know, not catastrophic in the way that Sid talks about? And John Erickson, do you think that there is, you know, this potential for us to do nothing, but also still reach that goal of negative growth because the world is changing and, you know, the impact that we've had on it is going to ultimately boomerang back on us?
Well, it's always a question of, do we transition to limits the way we'd like to, or do we crash into them and suffer the consequences? countries, for example, who have resisted family planning historically, countries like Pakistan, are actually now embracing family planning, not necessarily because of population questions, but because of lack of water access and declining water and water scarcity. We know that since 1992, the urban population on Earth has more than doubled. And we know that most of the urban population is in coastal cities. So the climate change factor is increasingly important and linked to conversations around the world now, where climate change is linked to the question of population and family planning.
But aren't we also being told that having an urban population is a better way to deal with a growing population, because then you can have more spaces for agriculture and more spaces for other types of land use, even for conservation, that a concentrated urban environment is a better choice than a fragmented suburban or, you know, semi-rural and getting less and less rural population?
Yeah, urban populations are also the source of tremendous amount of wealth and income. And so when we think about urban metabolism, when we think about the needs of urban communities and how they draw on resources indeed from around the world, it's a more complicated question than just simply looking at, for example, transportation per capita or other local environmental impacts that we can reduce. And we see that reduction, for example, in places like New York City. We see a local per capita consumption impact much lower than other parts of the world, but a global impact of that tremendous amount of income. So the urban, we use the word metabolism, you know, how that urban community functions is a huge part. And the fact that, again, population's doubled in 50 years, economy has quadrupled, but world trade has 10 times grown over itself in the last 50 years.
So, Bill Ryerson, is this just a numbers game of reducing the number of people, or is it also, I mean, of course it is, but how do you weigh the question of numbers versus consumption and people who have higher socioeconomic status, who live in wealthier countries, and the population in general in those wealthier countries really having a much larger impact on consumption and on CO2 and on all of these things that we also think about when we think about the ways we need to curb our use of non reusable resources?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very clearly the case that in the West we're producing carbon dioxide and consuming resources at many times the per capita rate in developing countries. And therefore, indeed, number one, we need to move towards a system where excessive consumption is not encouraged. That's why I mentioned New Zealand as a model where most people are middle class, but there's not that huge diversity between or discrepancy between the very wealthy and the poor. And second, it's important for people living in this country to think about the consequences of childbearing decisions. Two statisticians at Oregon State University did a study of carbon legacy, which is looking at assumptions about various generations after the current generation with regard to efficiency of energy use and so on. So carbon dioxide consequences of childbearing decisions now. And what they found was that an American couple who decides to have one less child is making a contribution to the health of the climate 5.7 times greater than their own carbon dioxide output. So clearly for American couples thinking about the future, their role in both energy efficiency and in childbearing decisions have huge impacts on the planet.
So should we be thinking more about curbing population growth in wealthy countries, which already tend to have a slower population growth than some of the other non-Western countries?
It's not either or. Now the developing countries of the world put out more carbon dioxide than the developed countries. So both are important. Roughly, the median projection from now to 2050 of an additional 2.5 billion people, mostly in very low-income, low per capita carbon emission countries, is the climate equivalent of adding 2 United States to the planet. So we can't afford to say it's this or it's that. It's both.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. We're talking really globally, but also, of course, this is a conversation that affects Vermont and is talked about and thought about locally. So let's turn to Robert Fyrovid, who's executive director of Better Not Bigger Vermont. That's an organization that says discouraging population growth is one of the best ways to diminish the negative impacts of human activity and preserve the local landscape right here in Vermont. Robert, it's nice to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Jane, and I want to thank you for airing this topic. It's wonderful that more media outlets are talking about this, and it opens a lot of hope for the future.
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about and talk about. And of course, this is a conversation that's happening at a lot of different levels. And we're all going to be impacted not only by changes to the climate, but by what our governments do and the policies that we promote and the way our culture works. So it's an important conversation to be having as it's happening elsewhere as well. And, you know, you think about this at the local level. So when we talk about Vermont, which is already considered one of the most, you know, it's a very weird statistic the way it's calculated, but a very rural state in this country, a state that has, if not the slowest, one of the slowest rates of population growth. Why is this something that you're still encouraging Vermont to think about in terms of slowing that growth even more?
Well, I have to admit, Jane, that I am an environmental refugee from outside of Washington, D.C., where I saw the environment being degraded by continued growth in the economy and the population there. And we came to Vermont for another life and that's more healthy, and met a lot of other people who have come here too and who appreciate what Vermont has to offer and wants to maintain that. And so that's why we started this organization.
Yeah, but so are you saying, hey, it's good here, I don't want other people to get what I got? I mean, what do you see as the reason why we should all be doing this?
Because it's not about, if I could say, well, I'll go ahead and plan my passing on, if that's what's going to maintain this, I would do that. But the reality is that as Bill and John were alluding to, there's a great deal of inertia in our economic system to continue the growth model. And it's we need all the voices we can to step up and say, wait a minute, we need a new paradigm. The world is different. We need to change the way we're doing things.
So, Bob, what would you do right now in terms of what you'd like to see at the state government level? We're here in the last couple of days of the legislative session, and in the last few months we've heard a lot of questions about economic incentives, getting people to move here, or the high costs of childcare. And obviously for people who already have children, that's a huge economic issue. Mm-hmm. But in terms of discouraging population growth, what would you like to see at the state level?
Well, there are some population issues that are unique to Vermont that need to be dealt with. Reducing the population or even stabilizing it necessarily is not the only piece of the puzzle. There are rural areas that are shrinking and are hurting because of that. And although some of the programs that the legislature and the governor's office have implemented, for instance, the effort to bring in telecommuters, can help in that regard. The way that it's designed, a lot of those people are going to be moving into highly urban areas that are already overcrowded, like the Burlington area and Washington County area. If we could get those people targeted more to rural areas that are shrinking, Iowa State is developing a program project to help, because they're a very rural state as well, and they're working on trying to shrink smart because they have the same problems. Their rural communities are losing population, losing economic opportunities, and so they're trying to figure out ways to help the rural communities, and there are ways, and they're starting to implement those. And we would like to see Vermont do something similar.
So, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about. And are there actual policies that you are pursuing, that you're lobbying for in Montpelier and that you're starting to see traction on?
Not yet. I mean, we are lobbying to try and do something similar to what is being done in Iowa, to try and target communities that really need the help. But it's difficult to get the attention of legislatures, policymakers, because, again, we have such an inertia of past efforts in the knee-jerk reaction is we need to grow the economy. We need to grow the economy. That will solve all our problems.
That's Robert Feyerovid, Executive Director of Better Not Bigger Vermont. And again, it's an organization discouraging population growth in an effort to preserve the Vermont landscape. Bob, I appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Well, Better Bigger Vermont really appreciates our participation. Thank you.
Let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Burlington. Bill, hi. Go right ahead. You're on the air. Bill, you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
No, I'm afraid we can't hear you. All right, go right ahead. See if we've got you. Go ahead. Bill, we don't have you, and we're running out of time. So I'm going to have to say that we can't take your call right now. But I want to ask John Erickson. You know, we were just talking there to Bob Feyerovid about this question of, okay, so what's the policy? What policies are we looking for here? What do you think? What policies are we looking for here that you think could not destabilize the population we currently have, but could work to incentivize a slower growth rate or even a negative growth rate?
Well, if we could stay with the context of Vermont, there's a really vibrant conversation happening right now around the Green New Deal, which includes within the Green New Deal a conversation of species extinction, ecosystems, soil maintenance, carbon. How do we live and inhabit the earth is the center part of that conversation. So in Vermont, how our population interacts with the environment is a conversation about forest fragmentation, water pollution, soil depletion, wetland loss. This session we talked about Act 250, our signature land use policy. That's an important part of this population conversation. In Vermont, you know, this is we're not immune to this. Endangered or threatened animals in Vermont, 52. Endangered or threatened plants in Vermont, 163. And again, our consumption is 4 to 5 times higher than the global average and well over 50 times higher the average of low-income communities. So we have to start to have that conversation. Does that consumption meet the good life standard? Is that consumption actually well-being, or actually would we be better off at a much, much smaller rate of consumption?
And zoom us out here, Bill. What about globally? What do you want to see on the global landscape?
Clearly work to educate girls and to make family planning services and information available. When you look at reasons for non-use of contraception, it's often misinformation about safety and effectiveness or various forms of opposition. So, in fact, doing programming like that of Population Media Center to change norms with regard to treatment of women and girls and their reproductive health is critically important.
And when you say educate girls, you don't mean necessarily educate girls on family planning. You mean educate them, give them an education, because that shows that they have a much lower birth rate in women who have been educated.
Exactly. For every year of secondary school education, birth rates fall.
Well, you know, it's an interesting conversation to have here and one that we know is happening elsewhere. So we'll continue to follow it and look at what's happening. And maybe, you know, in 10 years, we can have you back and see how well we've done on the policies that you've espoused. William Ryerson is president of the South Burlington-based Population Media Center. John Erickson is professor of sustainability science and policy at UVM's Rubenstein School of Environmental and Natural Resources. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And happy World Bee Day.